act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Ku San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hello, Commander. It's the title of a new epic song themed with support for the Islamic Revolution and its leader, from the mouth of Iranian children. The pop choir has recently been chanted in every corner in Iran, from TV shows to schools and public places. On Thursday, some 100,000 people jam-packed Tehran's Azadi Stadium to sing along Salam Farmande, Persian for Hello Commander.
Although we have not seen the Islamic revolution, but we, as the new generation, will hold on to the ideals of the revolution and our leader. This is the theme of this song.
Hello Commander is about our Imam Mahdi. In the song, we urge Imam Mahdi's hasty arrival to save humankind from cruelty.
The song addresses Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam, and the prophesied apocalyptic savior in Shia Islam, who is believed to be currently living in occultation.
I brought my children to this gathering because they love Imam Mahdi. Here, they learn to be the soldiers of Imam Mahdi.
I came to show my love for Imam Mahdi. In the song, we assure our leader that we will be loyal to Imam Mahdi.
In a part of the song, children promise Imam Mahdi that they will tread on the path of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force commander, who was assassinated by the United States in Iraq in 2020.
In this song, we as the new generation vow to be the next Qasem Soleimani. We are proud of him because he brought us security. I wish he was here today.
The song was first broadcast from Iran's national television on March 20th this year, after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a televised Persian New Year speech. Since then, the song has been performed in schools and national public occasions as a show of support for the Islamic Republic.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism." And some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member, it sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found Stingers and Javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of Javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown. Pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here, and he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Bouriza, London.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shut down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hudaydah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning, not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. The article you're about to hear has been written by Nicholas Kristof, a former New York Times opinion columnist. Nicholas Kristof was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Oregon this year. The piece is titled, "These Gun Reforms Could Save 15,000 Lives. We Can Achieve Them." Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning and not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. But we're tired of commemorating gun violence in America only with thoughts and prayers. We didn't respond to the 9/11 attacks only with moments of silence, or to Pearl Harbor just with lowered flags and memorial services. No, we resolved to act, even though these were hard challenges with no perfect solutions. Gun policy is likewise complicated and politically vexing, and we're not going to make everyone safe. Still, experts suggest that over time, we plausibly could reduce gun deaths by a third, or 15,000 lives saved annually, with a series of pragmatic limits on firearms and those who can get them. Instead, we're paralyzed in ways that threaten our democracy and our well-being. American children and American teenagers are 57% more likely to die young compared with children and teenagers in other advanced countries. And guns are one important reason. One study found that Americans aged between 15 and 19 are 82 times more likely to be shot dead than similarly aged teenagers in our peer countries. Let's just acknowledge that what we're doing isn't working, and we need new approaches. So what's a way forward? This will be painful for many of my fellow liberals, but I suggest that we work harder to engage centrists, talk about gun safety rather than gun control, and jump into the weeds. Social scientists suggest complexifying an issue to reduce polarization, and sure enough, I find that I can sometimes have productive conversations with gun enthusiasts if we focus on technocratic details. For example, consider the minimum age to buy or possess a gun. The suspects in both the Uvalde, Texas and Buffalo, New York shootings were only 18 years old, and that's not surprising. Americans aged between 18 and 20 account for 4% of the population, but 17% of those known to have committed a murder. In Wyoming, one of the most pro-gun states in America, the minimum age to buy a handgun is 21. Overall, one-third of states limit purchase of a handgun to those who are age 21 or older, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. If we say that teenagers can't buy alcoholic drinks, isn't it worth having a conversation about whether they should be able to buy Glock 19 handguns and AR-15 style rifles? One study found that 17% of all firearm offenders obtained guns legally, but would not have been able to do so if their state required handgun purchases to be at least 21. Even more would have been ineligible to buy guns if there had been limits imposed on those with drug and alcohol convictions. That's another conversation to have. We typically don't allow people with felony convictions to possess firearms. And wouldn't it also make sense to bar purchases by someone with a recent misdemeanor conviction for drug or alcohol abuse, for violence, or for stalking? Only 10 states bar people with stalking convictions from buying guns. We know that people going through breakups are particularly at risk to themselves and to their ex-partners. So why not pass red flag laws that allow guns to be removed from someone who is undergoing a mental health crisis or subject to a domestic violence protection order? Even former President Donald Trump has backed red flag laws. What about universal background checks to buy a firearm? Opinion polls suggest that gun owners themselves overwhelmingly favor universal background checks, yet 22% of firearms are obtained without them. In much of America, there is a more thorough review of people adopting a rescue dog than of those buying assault rifles. And should we really continue to allow people on the no-fly list to buy firearms but not board a plane. These are pragmatic steps that won't eliminate gun violence or avert every shooting incident, but they can make our country a bit safer. And while they will feel flimsy and unsatisfactory to many, they would at least break the paralysis on sensible gun policy. They would indicate that some progress is possible at a time when gun-related deaths have been worsening. Nineteen elementary school children died in the Texas school shooting on Tuesday, 24th of May, along with two teachers. 9 days earlier, six people were shot in a California church, one fatally, and five were shot, two fatally, at a Texas flea market. A day before that, a gunman killed 10 people in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York. When New Zealand experienced a mass shooting in 2019, that country acted in just 26 days to tighten gun laws. But here in America, it has been 56 years since one of the first gun massacres, the University of Texas Tower shooting in 1966, that claimed the lives of 17 people. Yet we know that gun safety is not a hopeless task, because just about every other country manages to do better. The Onion satirical website regularly responds to mass shootings with the headline, "No way to prevent this," says only nation where this regularly happens. It has a point. The result of our paralysis is that just since 1975, more Americans have died from guns, including suicides, murders and accidents, than in all the wars in United States history, going back to the American Revolution. Is the Second Amendment an obstacle? Perhaps to some degree, but most of us, judges included, recognize that we need some limits on weapons. Few believe that private citizens should be able to possess mortars, or that it's okay for 15-year-old teenagers to buy assault rifles. The practical question is a difficult one of where precisely to draw the lines. The truth is that we're not going to ban guns in the United States any more than we're going to ban alcohol, motorcycles, hunting knives, cigarettes or other products that can be deadly. Screaming maximalist fights about gun control versus the Second Amendment have created a political stalemate as we continue to lose 45,000 lives a year to gun violence. That's 123 lives lost in a single day. This does not happen in other countries. Japan typically loses a single-digit number of people to gun murders in a year. We lost twice that in a single school shooting incident on Tuesday. Whenever I write about guns, I get indignant protests. Cars kill about as many Americans a year as guns do, but you don't ban cars. No, but we do work to make vehicles safer. Auto safety is a boring, non-politicized endeavor driven by engineers that has enabled us to live with dangerous objects, that is cars, and reduce the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by more than 90% of the population since 1923. Likewise, we have a non-politicized safety process for ladders, swimming pools and toys. 8 pages of federal regulations on ladders, which kill around 100 people a year, with safety campaigns including making March Ladder Safety Month. Why can't we take a similar evidence-based approach to guns, not aiming for mass confiscation, but for reducing the carnage? For example, we require a license to operate a car, so why not a license to buy a gun? That's the law in Massachusetts, which has one of the lowest gun mortality rates in America. And while Massachusetts is a liberal state where one might expect tighter gun laws, Permits are also required through a simpler process to buy a handgun in North Carolina. Texas had such a requirement, but last year approved a new law ending the mandate for a license to carry a handgun. Addressing gun violence must also include a strong mental health component, as the military recognizes in its strategy to reduce suicides. Likewise, social programs like Cure Violence and Becoming a Man aren't specifically about guns, but do appear to reduce gun violence. There are many other steps that we can take. Safe storage requirements for firearms keep guns from children and thieves. Some 380,000 guns are stolen annually from private owners in the United States. We need to crack down on ghost guns assembled by the purchaser from parts without a serial number or any background checks. We must curb the next technology, firearms made by 3D printers. Let's be driven by evidence, which means more research. What about voluntary gun buybacks to reduce the pool of 400 million guns already in America? What about warning labels and guns, cautioning that a firearm in the house increases the risk of a gun death? What about a tax on guns to cover some of the external costs of their misuse, just as we tax cigarettes? What about universal background checks to buy ammunition? How about waiting periods or a limit of 2 gun purchases a month per person? How about a crackdown on straw purchasers who equip gangs? America is losing ground to guns. An estimated 18.8 million firearms were sold in the United States last year. The United States already has the highest number of firearms per capita by far. Yemen, in the midst of a civil war, ranks second. American civilians appear to have more assault weapons, the civilian versions, than the United States military has of the automatic version. So spare us the pious calls to avoid politics. Rather, let's supplement thoughts and prayers with concrete steps based on nerdy evidence gathering, based on hard conversations with people we disagree with to reduce gun deaths so that elementary schools need not be graveyards.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The annual flag march by extremist Israeli settlers through Al-Quds Old City planned to go ahead. This is regarded by Palestinians as a blatant provocation and also a violation of their rights. Even though Palestinian resistance groups have warned Israel against this, saying that they will retaliate if the regime goes ahead with a provocative march, the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that Israel is determined to hold the flag march. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why Israel is disregarding what is seen as being provocative, while at the same time provoking Palestinians into a possible confrontation. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, joins us from Madison. Also joining us from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, who joins us from Edinburgh.
The This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Kevin Barrett, first over to you. We're looking at a march that is deemed to be controversial and provocative. Maybe you can give us a background as to why that is being deemed as such.
The 1967 War of Aggression, which is recognized as such essentially by the whole international community, was organized in order to steal land that the Zionists felt they needed or wanted. And in the case of Jerusalem al-Quds, it was more wanting than needing it. They didn't need it for military purposes so much as a symbolic kind of triumph for them to proclaim that they, the Zionist movement, now totally owned and dominated the Holy Land that had been administered by Muslims on behalf of Jews and Christians, as well as Muslims, ever since Islam began. So there was a symbolic dimension to this, and the Israelis fanatically celebrated the Zionist takeover of the Holy City, and the ethnic cleansing process began as very large numbers of Palestinians were immediately expelled, and that process has continued to this day. So by running around waving flags, celebrating a criminal war of aggression — remember, aggression is the supreme war crime, and this war had been plotted for years by Ben-Gurion and others going back to the 1950s. This war crime is being not just celebrated, but being kind of shoved in the face of the victims, that is, the remaining Palestinians who haven't yet been ethnically cleansed. And by running around waving these flags, they're symbolic of genocide and ethnic cleansing in their faces, is essentially bragging about continuing this ethnic cleansing process. And we're seeing that happen all the time as they're still demolishing buildings. They're using fake legal processes to evict Palestinians. And there is an ongoing Zionist Jewish demographic takeover of Jerusalem al-Quds. So naturally, this is a little bit like when Nazis marched through Skokie, Illinois, here in the United States many, many years ago, waving swastika flags in a Jewish neighborhood in order to provoke the residents.
Okay.
And similarly, the same thing is happening here.
Now, what we understand, McNabb, here, is that this, according to the way that Israeli sees it, is meant to celebrate the capture of al-Quds back in the 1967 war. But when they went ahead and annexed that area, that is a step that is not recognized by the international community. So it's a law that's being broken by the way that they have gone about this. So why is it that they are able to mark this when it's illegal by international standards?
Because those international standards are formally acknowledged on paper by, for example, my government, but even the USA some of the time in the EU. But the way they respond to that is by supporting and arming those who violate those very same norms. Our other guest has said that aggressive war is the ultimate crime in the international canon, but you know that, and it, because it's the source of all the other crimes that flow from it. But my own government is quite ready to endorse aggressive wars. But if we can focus on Jerusalem in particular, the reason why Palestinian resistance factions and the whole Palestinian people, I would say, are very concerned about this march is because they remember what happened a year ago. And if you remember, horrible pictures were sent around the world of police attacking, Palestinians defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, rubber bullets, tear gas. In fact, so much tear gas and other inflammable material was fired that a tree in the compound went on fire. And that picture of seemingly the Al-Aqsa Mosque on fire caused noisy celebrations in the Jewish plaza below the Wailing Wall. It was a genocidal demonstration. People were celebrating a fire at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They were very much hoping that the mosque would be burned down. They were chanting genocidal slogans about the Palestinians, quote unquote, "May their names be erased," biblical slogans for the modern. And these people were celebrating what they thought was a fire at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, these demonstrations are endorsed by the Israeli government. Sometimes they take some cold feet, but generally they're endorsed. And many of the most genocidal groups taking part in these demonstrations actually receive funding from the Israeli government. And you have to think about these youths. They're generally young men who are demonstrating, calling for genocide against the Palestinians. In a year or two's time, they will be in uniform in the occupied territories or maintaining the siege of Gaza, and they will operate with complete impunity, an ability to shoot and kill Palestinians. Connect what we saw a year ago in the March of the Flag, so-called Jerusalem Day March, with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed with complete impunity by an Israeli sniper. The general mood among these youths and many of these soldiers is murderous. And the fact that it's celebrated openly by the Jerusalem Day March is, of course, shocking to some liberal people who would like to defend Israel. But it really marks the political tendency inside Israel that's in the ascendant at the moment. And in fact, one member of the Israeli parliament, more than one, several of them called for the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And they operate completely openly as heroes to a big section of the Israeli public. So the resistance factions are obviously very concerned. They realize they have to take a stand. Israel will only respect force in this area.
I guess there, Kevin Barrett talks about how the lead up to this national, as Israelis call it, the so-called National Flag Day, which is going to be attended by Israeli nationalists or Israeli extremist settlers, along with the fact that you have the assassination of that reporter, Shireen Abu Akleh, and all the tensions that exist with other deaths that have occurred in the past days, is not the right time for this to have happened. Why is it that given that you have the prime minister, which at some point this was actually delayed, okay this march that would possibly just flare up that area, if not the region?
Well, of course, we have to suspect that even though it's not the right time from the perspective of those of us who would prefer peace, it may be the right time from the perspective of Bennett and the other extremist crazies who run Israel. They typically do stage these provocations at the times when they have scheduled something that will work with them. And so we've seen in the past that at the convenient times that the Israelis want an excuse to crack down, for instance, to mow the lawn, as they call it, in Gaza and slaughter a few thousand civilians for no particular reason other than just mowing the lawn, they provoke Palestinians. We saw this, for instance, in early 2001, as Israel was preparing for its September 11th false flag operation in the United States, carried out with neoconservatives who were theoretically dual loyalists, but I think actually more loyal to Israel than the United States. They were going to use 9/11 as an excuse to crush the Palestinian movement, and of course they would, with extreme violence, not just murdering all sorts of people in Palestine, but also murdering Edward Said here in the United States, murdering, of course, Yasser Arafat, and so on. So they used 9/11 to crush the Palestinian movement, and the way they were able to set that up, at least the part in occupied Palestine, was by leading, you know, Ariel Sharon leading these kinds of invasions of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, getting the Palestinians all stirred up, getting a lot of footage of what the Western media, which is dominated by Jewish folks with some degree of loyalty to Zionism, would call clashes. So they get the clashes going, then they stage whatever it is that they're looking for, and they use the excuse of so-called clashes or Palestinian resistance to get what they want. So I think they're probably planning something. I don't know precisely what it is, but I don't think this is accidental. I think the Israeli authorities or whoever is behind them are planning to perhaps expand the war one way or another, whether going after Hezbollah, maybe even going after Iran in a bigger way than they have, maybe bombing Syria in a bigger way than they have, maybe cracking down on the Palestinians in an even bloodier way than they have so far. And they're going to use the excuse that there have been clashes and unrest. And, of course, they're the ones who produce the so-called clashes and unrest. It's all a response to their own aggression.
All right. While Kevin Barrett was speaking there, McNapp here, I went to look at what you were talking about when you talked about the celebrations that some of these Israelis or extremists, if you want to call them, or the settlers, were celebrating based on the fire that happened at that Al-Aqsa Mosque. And what I'm looking at over here is just a particular, I guess, a tweet at that point. It doesn't matter who tweeted it, but it's that crazy image of thousands of Israelis celebrating this what they call Jerusalem Day, while a fire blazes on the Temple Mount where Arabs are protesting and police is trying to stop them. When you take a look at this type of sentiment, are we looking just at what is being termed as Israeli nationalists or extremist settlers who hold this view? Or are we looking at the broad spectrum when it comes to Israelis as a whole, holding that type of views on Palestinians?
The liberal. I use the word in commas, American Jewish newspaper, The Forward, reported, together with many others, a couple of elections ago, that the election between Netanyahu and Gantz, and it's really repeated in almost every election, was who could boast that they had killed the most Palestinians? Netanyahu, of course, was a deeply racist anti-Palestinian prime minister. But he was challenged from the so-called centre ground by Benny Gantz. And in the election, Gantz had an election video in which he showed pictures of Palestinian funerals in Gaza. And in the corner of the video was a counter of how many people had been killed. Terrorists, he said, but he means Palestinians, during this attack on Gaza. And he boasted in this election video, "Please vote for me. I pushed Gaza back to the Stone Age." Now, it doesn't get any more revolting than that to ask for votes from the general public because you are more murderous than your opponent, that you show pictures of funerals and you have a death counter in the corner of your election video. There is so much evidence to show that the Israeli so-called left has disappeared. And the spectrum of political opinion in Israel is pretty much right, extreme right, and genocidal right. And they compete for the popular vote. And there's nothing Jewish about this. This is fairly standard in a settler colonial project, where the whole aim in South Africa or centuries earlier America or Australia or Israel or Palestine today, the aim is to remove all the native people by violence, because you can't do it by singing songs. And because it's an inherently violent project of ethnic cleansing, it has to constantly energize its own base. It has to discuss genocide. It has to allow murderous elements to actually come to the fore. Because if you tried to stop that, the whole logic of Zionism would be challenged. Look, the ex-chief rabbi in Britain, a guy called Jonathan Sachs, who presented himself as a liberal, He made a personal appeal for Jews to come with him to the March of the Flags in Jerusalem. He said, "Us and dance with our brave Israeli soldiers." That was in Britain, and the British political establishment went along with that. Similar stories could be shown from all around the world. Mm. The Palestinians are in great danger. They have the local Arab regimes in the Gulf and Morocco and Egypt are working together with Israel. They even share intelligence and weapons and so on. And the Palestinians are deeply alarmed. Who are their allies? Who can they rely upon? And they're beginning to realize that their doom is the only alternative to resist. Not beginning, sorry. They've always understood this. But if they don't resist this, then there is no limit to Zionist appetites to remove them.
There have been signs of improvement in the way that Palestinians are making their cause to show, especially to the world, Kevin Barrett. And this Ramadan, there was one instance where you had some Palestinian youths, as it was reported, to have managed to actually bring into the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque where the Dome of the Rock was a picture or a banner, actually, not a picture, a banner of a Hamas fighter, of which they hung up in front of the Dome of the Rock. And that's something that a few years ago, based on one particular senior Western diplomat, as he was quoted, was saying that it just wouldn't be unimaginable for something like that to happen in Al-Quds. So what does that say about the way that Palestinians have resisted and in defiance and taking all the risks that involves probably their lives to have managed to done something like this?
That's right. You know, our hearts have to go out to these brave young Palestinians who are carrying the torch of resistance to genocide after these generations have passed before them. And the Zionists have arranged things so that for each individual Palestinian, the easiest way to go is to try to find a way to get out and go try to thrive somewhere else and forget about the whole issue. That's part of the ethnic cleansing process. As you kill some, you expel others, and then you make it easier for the survivors to leave than to stay. But there have been brave Palestinians who've been staying and struggling throughout the entire process. And indeed, the genocide of Palestine has been a failure. They have not managed to drive out the Palestinians, and indeed they're still facing what they call a demographic problem, which is one of the reasons that they celebrate, you know, exterminating these the people they call cockroaches and so on, putting up little counters to count how many civilians that they murder, because they see that they have not succeeded in their extermination project. So these young Palestinians who are still fighting are incredibly courageous, and they really stand in sharp contrast to the wealthy, pampered elites in parts of the Arab world, especially the Gulf, where it seems that at least among the elites, they've decided that it's better to work with the Zionist Antichrist than to resist it. And so these Palestinian young people are setting an example for all of us in all parts of the world struggling for justice on so many issues. The young people here in North America who are struggling against the COVID tyranny that's being imposed based on this U.S. bioweapons disaster of COVID-19, and then maybe this new U.S. bioweapons monkeypox disaster. There is a huge resistance movement here in the United States and Canada and across Europe. And there are so many other of these issues where this over-the-top oppression, what we call dhulm in Islam, is being resisted. And especially by these brave young people who have everything to lose and have their whole lives to live. So we just have to salute them.
McNabb here, maybe we can take just a quick time from you to explain how Palestinians revere, obviously, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, during the month of Ramadan and prior, even to the prior Ramadans, Palestinians, especially the younger ones, they actually pay smugglers to bring them into the compound so that they can just go and pray, because Israeli forces, obviously, if they see them, they won't allow them in because they have restrictions when it comes to age, and usually it's the younger ones that are restricted. And that's how holy and how high in value this particular praying is for them. But that is considered, as Israel sees it, terrorism if they were to come in. But yet when they have the Israeli settlers or Israeli nationals walking through, that's okay. Can you open that up for us a little bit, if you can?
Yes. I mean, if Jews are attacked in Britain, as sometimes happens, genuine anti-Semitism, we obviously support them. But in Israel, in Palestine, we have a Jewish supremacist state. And although it was founded largely by atheists, the vanguard of the ethnic cleansing operation has to some degree been taken over by religious extremists. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is something that they simply have to destroy. So for Palestinians, it's clearly a religious institution of the highest importance, and it should be across the whole Muslim world. But it's also the heart of their Palestinian identity. And, you know, there's never been a day in Palestine. People should celebrate this. When Muslims and Christians have fought, they have always coexisted peacefully together, and they did with Jews before the dark shadow of Zionism appeared. And, you know, when the Israeli regime has moved against Muslims, Christian groups have said, we will make that you can come and make the call to prayer from our churches, from our church steeples. So it's a very important institution for Muslims, but for the whole Palestinian people. And for that very reason, it's a target for the Israelis. The Israelis want to remove Palestinians. They also want to obliterate Palestinian history. And that and part of that is obliterating the religion of the great majority of Palestinians for its replacement by a Jewish supremacist state. That's why it's so fantastically important for Palestinians to defend their own history, their own memory, their present culture, and their hopes for the future. And it's equally important for the Israelis at some stage to find the right moment to destroy it. And unless Muslims worldwide come to the support of the Palestinians, they may succeed.
All right, last question goes to you, Kevin Barrett. Benny Gantz, who said that this march has to go on, came out and in defiance of just everybody saying that, you know, you're going to look at clashes that are going to happen on that day. He said, "You will not threaten our sovereignty," quote, is what Benny Gantz said, believing that also that there's not going to be any type of retaliation or a repeat, I should say, of what happened last year where Hamas had rockets fired into Israel, and it was quite successful in doing so. Why do you think Benny Gantz would say that when Hamas has clearly threatened Israel with retaliation?
He's obviously trying to provoke the Palestinians to create the very clashes that he thinks he can profit from one way or another. Perhaps they're planning an operation, as I suggested, or perhaps he's just trying to benefit politically. As we heard, who counts the most Palestinian civilian body, the one who wins the insane genocidal. So he doesn't mind these, doesn't mind killing. He well is trying to trigger it that he's doing. And the Palestinians are defending this, as he said, because Al-Aqsa is a crucial spiritual symbol for Muslims and indeed to some extent for Eastern Christians as well, who've been living side by side with Muslims in peace for so many centuries. The okay. Al-Aqsa Mosque is the place where the Prophet Muhammad rose through the heavens. And it's very the well. Symbol of Islamic spirituality in this tradition of Abrahamic monotheism. It's a beautiful, important place, and the people defending it deserve our thanks and our praise.
Thank you. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today from Madison, and Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Meek Napier there from Edinburgh. Thank you for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.